mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. And what a fascinating discussion we have for you this hour of the program. As I mentioned before, I've always been a big fan of Indiana Jones. Well, there are real guys out there, just like Indiana Jones, digging into the great mysteries of what you might think of as fringe archaeology. And one of them is going to be with us this hour. His name is Jamie Hildebrand. This guy has 4 degrees. He has a degree in psychology, one in anthropology, one in archaeology, and one in religious studies. And one great thing about Jamie is, well, he is not censored by academia. That's because he's not out there seeking teaching positions. That gives him a chance to dig into the subject matter and look for truths that stare everyone else in the face, but they're often too afraid to talk about out loud. And we're talking about things related to, well, digs that have turned up things that are inconsistent with the expectations of the mainstream archaeology. Certain aspects are brushed under the rug. We're talking about cave paintings, mummies, pyramids, underwater structures, all kinds of things that give us a new sense of what may have really happened in the past and how that we might need to rewrite some of the history books. So we can go into a lot of different directions tonight. And it's a great pleasure to say, Jamie Hildebrand, welcome, sir, to Speaking of Strange.
Well, hello, Joshua. It's always good to talk to you.
Absolutely. And I'm honored that you live here in the Asheville area. So you are sharing a lot of your experience and wisdom with people from our region. And, you know, we met each other not too long ago and talked for hours about some of the experiences that you've had. Now, just so everybody understands now, your degrees, these are legitimate degrees from accredited places. Where are your degrees from, Jamie?
The University of North Carolina at Greensboro, Joshua.
Okay, well, there you go. We're not talking to a guy here who just, you know, got online and you know, paid $25 or whatever and took a course. No, he is a real student of these subjects. And now, how in the world did you find time, Jamie, to get 4 degrees?
Oh, well, that's a complicated one. I started out wanting to go for psychology and got most of the way through that to discover I really didn't enjoy psychology. I was just really good at it. And moved towards my passions of anthropology and archaeology.
Now, are you one of those Indiana Jones fans like me?
Of course. Everyone's an Indiana Jones fan, I think at least. Indiana Jones is part of why I decided I wanted to be an archaeologist. The 5-year-old me watching Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's that point where you go, man, I want to go explore these ruins, punch Nazis, save the day, save the girl, get the girl.
It's amazing how sort of sexy, if you will, the Indiana Jones series made a topic which is otherwise quite dry. And, you know, I would think it'd be interesting to go back and look at how many students of archaeology just sort of blossomed after those movies came out. So tell us a little bit, though, about the reality, you know, comparing the showbiz sensationalism to what you actually do when you're out there on some of these digs and excavations.
Well, it's not likely you're going to find intact ruins anywhere close to what you see in the movies. There's not a lot of Nazis out there to punch anymore, and you're not likely to ever really get the girl so much that way. It's a lot of sitting in a basement with a toothbrush, cleaning artifacts, sorting them, cataloging them. It's dirty work. You spend most of your time in the after effects, in the lab work.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, now, we have a lot of different directions that we can go tonight. So I'll leave it up to you. Where should we begin? How do we set the stage for what you call fringe archaeology?
Well, one that I recently noticed, looking up a few things the other day, going on that whole Indiana Jones bend.
Right.
The Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
There was apparently a guy, Richard Andrews, who built a model of the Ark of the Covenant. And it's a primitive electrical accumulator. It would build up its own static charge over time, especially if it was being carried over a sandy desert in the heat.
Yeah. It's like a big capacitor, and of course, yeah, in the desert, it's extremely dry, and you're talking about something which is layered with gold, which is a fantastic conductor. And I've always thought it was weird when you read these accounts of the Ark of the Covenant, they talk about it levitating at certain times, and that doesn't make sense to us, but it almost seems like the Ark of the Covenant may have been more than just a box that artifacts were stored in, but some kind of a machine or a portal that was being used to communicate with greater beings, i.e. God, huh?
That is a distinct possibility. I mean, the scripture does say that it should be used, the cherub faces should be used as a communication.
Yeah. So now, when it comes to, let me just get your opinion on that. Where do you think the Ark of the Covenant is now? It's one of the big mysteries, isn't it?
Well, I'm going to have to lean towards Swiss banks.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm going to have to lean. They have a very Templar bent to them.
Mm-hmm.
Though arguments are made of this St. Mary Zion Chapel in Axum.
Mm-hmm.
So without seeing it for myself, I can't be certain where it would be, but I'd like to go find out.
Sure. Well, now, tell us some about the problems in archaeology, you know, what you call sort of the old boys club.
Okay. Well, a lot of people are aware that there's this group that gets to say everything there is about archaeology. I refer to it as the old boys club. You start talking about things that go against what they have researched and what they have found to be supporting their evidence, and they'll do their best to get you blackballed out of academia, so you won't be able to get work in universities. A lot of your papers might not get published in magazines, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. It goes
even further with some of the older men.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even seem to think that women belong in the field.
Wow.
I have seen this behavior myself. They might not do it outwardly and say it directly, but they will treat people differently under gender bias. That's just ridiculous in this day.
So it literally is an old boys club, then.
Absolutely.
And so now give us an example of, say, a situation that you're aware of in which something has been discovered by the old boys club and tossed out because it was inconsistent with their expectations and worldview.
Most of that is going to be dealing with the Clovis civilization.
Okay.
It's the term they put to it, basically based on a spear point,
mm-hmm.
the Clovis point. They date the civilization to 12,000 years ago in the Americas and say no civilization existed in the Americas before this date.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that says otherwise, they try to discredit in every way. There is no pre-Clovis civilization in the Americas, and I think that's just crazy because there's so much evidence saying that there is.
Okay, well, what are some examples of this evidence?
Well, we have the new evidence of the cave paintings in Serra de Capivara National Park in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I pronounced that right. I'm sorry. These cave paintings are dated to about 30,000 years ago.
Hmm.
You know, cave art that began in the Americas around the same time it began in Europe and Africa.
Okay, and so these cave paintings, they obviously indicate that there was some civilization that's pre-Clovis. And basically what you're saying is they still don't accept a pre-Clovis civilization?
No, it's hard to get anything published, anything taken seriously, if you're saying pre-Clovis.
Mm-hmm. And now, you told me also in your notes that there were some very interesting bog bodies that have been discovered right here in what we now call the good old USA.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In Florida, a site known as the Wendover site, they found bog bodies in the peat bogs, because for some reason the peat bog and the levels of chemicals in it, I'm not sure how that works exactly, preserved the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And originally they were dated to be 15,000 years old. But more recently, they're having a more modest dating of about 8,000 years old. I think this is probably because of pressure from the old boys club.
Well, you know, I have heard throughout the years these stories about these shadowy individuals that pop up on the scene when some type of really amazing find is discovered. And often they're associated with the Smithsonian. That's part of the story. And they step in and say, okay, we'll take it from here because we are the ones who have the knowledge and the expertise, and you're just going to screw it up. And they are somehow granted authority to go in, lock down the location. They take the discovery, and then it's never seen again. We're coming up on a break here, Jamie. When we come back, I want to get your take on whether or not you believe that this kind of thing does happen or has happened, at very least, where these folks come in and they commandeer a site. And if so, you know, where is it going? And I have my own thoughts on this, my own little conspiracy theory I'll interject. Folks, I'm talking right now with Jamie Hildebrand. And now, he is an expert in a number of fields, psychology, anthropology, archaeology, religious studies, but we're talking tonight specifically about fringe archaeology, stuff that is often brushed under the rug by, well, the old boys club of science. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You are listening to Speaking of Strange. exploring tunnels, ancient temples, old mines, having adventure as you explore these weird stories from the past. I mean, it doesn't matter what your resource is. Have you ever thought about the fact that before there were cameras around and methods of recording, everything we know about how human culture and civilization evolved was always based on eyewitness testimony, people writing down their experiences. And now, because of the scientific method, we're going back and we're trying to take an innovative approach, looking through all these pebbles and grains of sand to see if we can verify some of these stories, because people used to talk about the most fantastic things. Connections with other dimensions, other beings, magical powers, the dead coming back to life, you name it. It's all in there somewhere, and we're grasping for a piece of that mystical tradition. And those men and women who study this field we'll call fringe archaeology, they're right there on the cutting edge in that blurry boundary between the mainstream secrecy and the imagination. How did all this come to exist? You know, here's a story that's fascinated me for a long time, and this is an example of the kinds of things, the bits and pieces, the clues that you'll find. You know that in the 1880s in Philadelphia, according to newspaper accounts, human skulls with horns were discovered in a burial mound at Sayre, Bradford County, there in Pennsylvania. Horny projections extended at least 2 inches above the eyebrows, and the skeletons were 7 feet tall. But other than that, they were anatomically normal. It was estimated the bodies had been buried around AD 1200. The find was made by a supposedly reputable group of antiquarians, including a state historian, a dignitary of the church, a couple of professors, one named A.B. Skinner of the American Investigating Museum, another W.K. Moorhead of Phillips Academy from Andover, Massachusetts. The bones were sent to the American Investigating Museum in Philadelphia, where they were later claimed to have been stolen and have never been seen again. And there are stories like this that go on and on and on. And some of these stories, especially the more recent ones, they go beyond, well, this disappeared. They actually go to the extent that shadowy figures from the underworld of academia pop up. They take possession of these things, and then they are never seen in the mainstream again. They're lost. Now, Jamie Hildebrand, he is a man who studies fringe archaeology. Jamie, what do you think about these kinds of stories?
Well, I think this is a distinct possibility. I mean, you've got the older guys who've gained their power, got into a nice, comfy position. They have the things that they found. They have their legacy. And they're afraid that it's going to be taken away from them. They would behave this way. They would do everything they can to cover up things that would completely discredit their entire life's work.
Well, you know, it seems to me that if you look in particular at the Smithsonian Institution, they are primarily run by benefactors who give them millions, maybe even billions of dollars. I haven't looked at their accounting books, but people who give a ton of money. Now, if I were a super-duper rich guy, one of the, you know, Bill Gates types, and I went to the Smithsonian and sat down and said, guys, I'm willing to write you a $1 billion check, but there is one condition, there is one contingency. Whenever you find something that's really, really cool, guess who gets to look at it before anybody else? And maybe even put it into my private little collection for a while before you get it. Now, how many of these folks are going to turn down a $1 billion check if that's the condition? Because, hey, they get to see it. They get to be a part of the fun and the adventure. And that's why I'm willing to bet somewhere out there there's a billionaire, or maybe there are many billionaires, and if you are good friends, they'll invite you over for a nice dinner of bald eagle and bottlenose dolphin, and afterward, they'll take you down into the basement, and they'll show you the Sasquatch mounted in the corner, or the chupacabra, or the Nessie, or the skulls with horns. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm using my imagination quite a bit here, Jamie. But I mean, have you seen just little glimpses from your perspective that this may be the reality of how it works when something is discovered and taken over by the mainstream system?
Well, it's pretty funny you say it that way, because archaeology was doing that long before it was an academic pursuit. I mean, having your curio cabinet, that's what it was for. It was for your curiosities, those weird things you collected. It's what rich people did. Rich people were the only ones that were involved in archaeology early on. It was mostly to tomb rob.
Wow, that's a very good point. That's a very insightful point. So now, would you say that you've dug into fringe archaeology because that most of the archaeologists that you've encountered in the mainstream are kind of disappointing?
I've encountered a few that are good people, and they will generally not try to upset the status quo too much. I mean, it'll be little things. Like, I know one who found that slaves in the United States generally had firearms. And that shakes people up a little bit, but not too much. And you can get away with that. That's okay. Fine. That's not going too far.
So now, why was that a controversial issue?
Then people would start going, well, if the majority of the slaves were armed, what kept them where they were at?
Oh, okay. They could have had an uprising without the help of John Brown, for example.
But the reason that they were all armed is they were given a certain amount of food a day, mm-hmm. but for the amount of work they were doing, it wasn't enough calorie intake for their bodies. The rifles were so they could go hunt rabbits and deer, so they could supplement. Foodways is interesting, you know, sometimes, but...
Yeah. Well, Nikkei, now, moving on the list here, and actually, before we get to the next topic, you had mentioned to me at one point that there have been situations where archaeologists are doing a dig, and they go down, okay, this is the 2,000-year-old layer, okay, this is the 3,000-year-old layer, okay, this is the 4,000-year-old layer, and then they find something like a root beer can and say, oh, and throw it out and call the site contaminated, and move on instead of addressing the anomaly they've discovered. Would you like to talk a little about that?
I have heard many a lecture that involved some of the older archaeologists talking about their youth and things that they've done, and I've heard a few stories that involve finding something like a root beer can or root beer bottle, and they're usually told to throw it away and never speak of it. Because if they speak of it, then most of academia will consider the site contaminated and nothing there will be useful. And I think that they need to look into it more. Why was the site contaminated? Did somebody dig a well down this deep and dump trash? Is that why it was there?
Or did somebody from the future travel back in time drinking root beer, right?
That is a distinct possibility, too. We don't know what technologies are going to be developed in the future.
Yeah.
That could happen.
And I've read some fascinating books, some by, for example, Brad Steiger, where it appears very clear that tennis shoe prints that are fossilized have been discovered, and nobody can explain that one. We're coming up on another break. When we get back, we're going to talk some about these underwater structures that have been found around the world and what the significance of those are. I mean, you talk about being lost to history when something is swallowed up by the ocean. Oh, you know, nature wreaks havoc, and we'll see what we can learn about those underneath the ocean. I'm talking this hour with Jamie Hildebrand, He is an expert in what you might call fringe archaeology. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You are listening to the show where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange. Here's one I bet you've never heard of. 1856. France. Here's what the newspapers said, as well as other reports. A group of workmen were engaged in cutting a railway tunnel through some rocks at Caumont, Haute-Marne. They were breaking up an enormous block of stone when, quote, from a cavity in it, they suddenly saw emerge a living being of monstrous form. Quote, this creature, which belongs to the class of animals hitherto considered to be extinct, has a very long neck and a mouth filled with sharp teeth. It stands on four long legs, which are united together by two membranes, doubtless intended to support the animal in the air, and are armed with four claws, terminated by long and crooked talons. Its general form resembles that of a bat, differing only in its size, which is that of a large goose. Its membranous wings, when spread out, measure from tip to tip 3 meters, 22 centimeters. Its color is livid black. Its skin is naked, thick, and oily. End quote. What does that sound like? Pterodactyl. Okay? These guys claimed they cracked open this rock. A living pterodactyl came stumbling out. Can you imagine how scary that would be? And then collapsed and died right there in front of them. Where is it, though? That's where the trail ends. I could give you so many examples. As a matter of fact, you may not realize that humans never even realized that dinosaurs existed until the 1800s. The remains have always been here, but it wasn't until the 1800s when the scientific system got a large enough cohesive cross-section of data to start putting the pieces together and saying, maybe one time there were big, crazy-looking things that lived here when, you know, people were talking about dragons and giant monsters and what. Maybe there was something to that. Problem is, supposedly, humans didn't overlap with dinosaurs. But maybe that's wrong. Maybe a lot of what we believe is wrong regarding how this world and how us humans in that world have developed. That's what's so important about fringe archaeology. And that's what we're talking about this hour with Jamie Hildebrand. He's got 4 degrees. One of them is in anthropology. One's in archaeology. By the way, if any of you listening would like to contact Jamie, he lives here in Western North Carolina. You can email him. His email address is JB, as in Bob, JB Hilder, that's H-I-L-D-E-R, jbhilder@gmail.com, if you have any tips for him regarding further study. Okay, again, when it comes to that sort of a story, I mean, Jamie, what do you think? Any thoughts off the top of your head on what happens to these things when they're discovered?
Well, that creature is probably in someone's collection, as we previously discussed.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense to me. Wow, I don't...
Yeah, I mean, what can you say? It's a report, and, you know, I read it, and now it's supposedly lost to history, but there are a lot of others like that. Now, tell us, Jamie, about some of the underwater structures around the world that you think can give us insight into a different perspective on history.
Well, I really enjoy this subject. This is one I can talk about for quite some time. I'm hoping that you'll want to get scuba certified and go check some of them out with me sometime, Joshua.
I am scuba certified, so...
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Because anything that would be really important, I feel, that's older than about 12,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
the information we have is going to be incomplete at best. People like to build on coastal areas, especially near a river. So if you're next to a river and an ocean, go out a little ways. You're probably going to find something under there, I think. Because the level of the ocean today is nowhere near what it once was. About 12,000 years ago, the end of the last ice age, the sea levels rose. So any civilization that is older than that is underwater today.
Mm-hmm.
Such as off the coast of Japan. They have at least 15 buildings and roads. One of the buildings appears to be a stadium-like structure, and there's a pyramid. There's a pyramid off the coast of Japan underwater.
Mm-hmm.
It's dated back as far as 8,000 before the Common Era.
Wow.
Thousands of years before pyramids existed in Egypt. Many people like to think this might be evidence of the lost city of Mu, or lost continent of Mu,
uh-huh.
the Pacific Atlantis, more or less. I don't know if this is true, but I'd really love to find out, because underwater is where you're going to be able to explore those more intact ruins.
And so what are the larger implications, though, of finding something like that under the water? Because, I mean, like you said, this predates what we believe, what mainstream archaeologists believe about the Egyptian pyramids. But you know, how many people are going down there and learning, and I mean, what does this tell us about, you know, what was happening in the world at that time?
I'm thinking civilization, or an age of civilization that is lost, rose and fell long before we think it did. This is evidence of it. I mean, there's not a lot of academic study going on in the area. Mostly it's private funding, in Japan at least. There are various places. Portugal and Cuba have underwater cities as well.
Well, now, what is your opinion on pyramids in general? Why were pyramids such a big thing all around the world long, long ago?
Well, there's the roughly 140 of them in Egypt, used mostly for burial, it appears. But in Mesoamerica, not only were they used for entombment of the important people, but religious practices occurred there. They did their rituals at the pyramids. And here in North America, Monk's Mound at Cahokia is more or less a pyramid. It's just made of clay instead of stone.
Huh.
And at the top of it, that's their religious practices. It was important to their faith. interacting with their gods. In Egypt, they say the pyramid and its structure was to represent the rays of the sun coming down on us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about that, but hey, it could be.
Well, you know, to me it seems sensible that humans have always wanted to get closer to the heavens because, you know, we take for granted growing up in a day and age when we have satellites floating around out there. Well, we know we're on a round planet, and there's this big ball of fiery gas up there called the sun, and there's this rocky thing called the moon that we've gone up and stomped around on. I mean, but back in those days, I mean, you didn't know how far the ground beneath your feet extended. You didn't know what shape this piece of dirt was we're walking on. You look up, and you see these things that don't seem to follow the rules, these bodies in space. Once in a while, a rock falls out of the sky. You know, where did that come from? You know, it was a myth for most of human history that rocks could, you know, rocks can't fall out of the sky. They didn't understand how that can happen, how meteors could fall. And so it seems they wanted to be higher. They wanted to be closer to the sky. And the pyramid is just the most stable structure to get yourself closer, right?
Yeah, you're trying to get as close to your gods or your god as you can possibly get. I mean, we've been reaching for the heavens since the story of the Tower of Babel.
You know, Jamie, a few years ago, my producer Forrest and I and a group, we went down to the Mayan ruins in Belize, and we went to one called Lamanai, which is actually the most secluded of the Mayan ruins. And one of the great things about this location is that they'll still let you climb up on top of the pyramid there. And what's funny is that once you make the journey up to the top of this pyramid and you turn around and you see this epic view around you, you realize that if you had access to that pyramid, which towered over the trees and the foliage below, you literally could see the future. You could see if there was a storm coming in the distance. You could see if there was a boat coming. I mean, you had knowledge about what was heading in your direction. And knowledge is power. And so just by physically being positioned atop a pyramid and not allowing the rest of the population that point of view, you could dominate them and make yourself seem mystical because you see what's on the way and most of the people don't. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to wrap up this conversation, but I want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about cryptozoology and the archaeological record. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is the program where the unusual becomes usual. It is called Speaking of Strange. Thank you. final minutes of hour number two on tonight's Speaking of Strange. Coming up next hour, what we call it the Dark 30 Hour. That's when we talk about some of the more outrageous and controversial material, not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended. So you may or may not want to stick around for that kind of content. But this past hour, I've been talking with Jamie Hildebrand, and he lives in Western North Carolina. He has a number of degrees, including degrees in anthropology and archaeology. Again, if you would like to contact him, if you have something that might be related to his field of, well, fringe archaeology, his email address is JB Hilder. That's JBHILDER at gmail.com. And if it's okay with him, and I don't see why it wouldn't be, we'll put a link up at speakingofstrange.com as well. Before we move on to this little conversation on cryptozoology, anything else that you want to just toss out there for people who might want to get in touch with you or learn about your field, Jamie?
Absolutely. Everyone can feel free to email with any suggestions they have of further topics they might want me to bring to the table to discuss on your show at further dates. I'd love to hear what people want to hear about.
Yeah.
That would be very interesting. It'd give me a new direction.
Well, you know, I have, as most people know, the Asheville Mystery Museum in the basement of the Asheville Masonic Temple, and maybe you can be our official archaeologist and go out there and find all the weird little things that people might discover that belong in the museum. So I can be the Denim Elliot character to your Indiana Jones, right?
I love that place. I'll do everything I can for it.
I'll be Marcus Brady to your Indiana Jones.
All right.
Okay, so now tell us some, Jamie, about cryptozoology in the archaeological record.
I mean, we have all these accounts of, you know, vampire burials and all that. You know, the cliche, finding someone with iron stakes, staking them to their coffins, the head cut off, something shoved in their mouth. That changes depending on where you're at. Some places it's garlic. Some places it's a brick in the mouth. But it goes back much further than a drunk Irishman rambling about a bloodthirsty warlord. In the cuneiform tablets and in the cuneiform writings, you have talk of vampires and evil spirits and demons and ways to defend yourself against them. So that far back, we have people talking about something that is so popular today. Everybody wants to talk about vampires today, but in Sumeria, they were talking about this 4,000 BC.
And so, I mean, therefore, since we're talking about cryptozoology, you're thinking that, you know, there may have actually been non-human creatures that account for some of this?
That is a distinct possibility. All legend lies with just a shred of truth, if nothing else. There had to be someone stalking the night.
Well, you know, I've always thought it was interesting when you just look at some of the pioneer stories from just this area, Western North Carolina and East Tennessee. They had creatures like the Hodag and these kind of like, you know, river sirens and beasts that would supposedly eat you. And obviously, if indeed those creatures existed, they would have been killed very quickly by pioneers with rifles. And the remains of those creatures would not have lasted very long because I presume it is still the case that a single fossil has never been found in Western North Carolina because things deteriorate too quickly here.
The soil is way too acidic for fossils in this area, most of the woodland area, really.
Now, on the other hand, in East Tennessee, there was a sinkhole discovered about, I'm going to say, 13 years ago, that had all kinds of crazy remains in it, rhinoceros and elephants and tapers, and there's a museum that has these on display around Johnson City, Tennessee, which I plan to visit soon. I haven't been there yet. And just to follow up on something I said earlier, the word dinosaur was formally produced in 1842 by paleontologist Sir Richard Owen, right around the time that dinosaurs were being recognized in England and around the world. Well, you know, the clock has got us, Jamie. This has been a great discussion, you know, just bouncing around topic to topic. So we'll definitely have you back on to dig into some more specific areas of research. So, you know.
I'd love to do so for you.
All right. Well, excellent, because there is plenty to talk about. And little by little, you know, a candle in the dark, we will maybe put together a more meaningful picture of what exactly happened on this planet before, well, we were born. So thank you so much for being on the program tonight, Jamie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great time.
All right, folks. That was Jamie Hildebrand. Go email him. If you have access to something, maybe it's something in your grandma's attic, maybe it's something you dug up in the backyard, that's how great discoveries are made. When we come back, it will be time for, yes, the Dark 30 Hour. I am Joshua P. Warren, and you are listening to the show we call Speaking of Strange.